Howdy, y'all. How's the PowerShell thing working out? Good. Oh, that it? All right. Hey, Stephen, walk up here. One of the things we've been talking about a lot this week is DSC. You guys heard about DSC? Yeah. So, as you know, I helped write a book called The DSC Book, which we gave away a lot of print copies of, but you can get free copies at PowerShell.org. But I know a lot of folks were like, I want to get the other author. This is Stephen Murawski, so I wanted everyone to see what he looked like. Thank you, sir. Because apparently tall, geeky-looking guy with funny shoes isn't descriptive enough in our community. So welcome. This session is Windows PowerShell, let's call it really good practices, and not put best on there. That's a lot of pressure. And patterns. And the patterns part is actually going to be a little bit more important. My name is Don Jones. I am a Windows PowerShell MVP. I've been an MVP for about 11 years. I'm the president of PowerShell.org, so if you've not found the best place on the web to get free resources and some darn friendly people to answer questions, drop on by PowerShell.org. I'm a senior partner and principal technologist for Concentrated Tech. We do a lot of business level technology consulting and training and education and stuff like that. I've written a lot of books, including Learn Windows PowerShell in a Month of Lunches and many others. This session today is actually based in large part on a free ebook that we have at PowerShell.org called The Community Book of PowerShell Practices. Now, that the whole thing kind of evolved from the concept of the scripting game. So we had these big games, and in one edition of the games, we asked people in the community to comment on each other's code. Well, that was stupid. Because apparently we're an opinionated bunch, and we all have different opinions. So what we did after the games were over, we ran a series of blog posts on PowerShell.org over the summer, this was last year, called The Great Debates. And we positioned some of the more vexing problems and asked people to weigh in with their opinions and the reasoning behind those opinions. And then we kind of took the shared consensus, what there was of it, including all of the except when type situations, and we compiled those together into a book. And so you can go up and get that anytime you want. Now, as we go, please do feel free to ask questions. You will need to use the floor mics. Between the spotlights and everything else, I can't see you at all. And we are recording this and live streaming it, so it's going to be really helpful for posterity if everyone else can hear the question too. This is a lot of demo. There's not a lot of slides. I've thrown some in here to kind of summarize things. And here's what I did. At the bottom of each kind of introductory slide, it's going to have like example one or example two. Those correspond directly to the example scripts that I'm going to be showing you, and those are already posted online for your downloading pleasure, and there's the URL right there where you can get them. So I like did this thing where I thought ahead this time, which I never do. So mostly demonstrations, and we're mostly going to be talking about how to start taking PowerShell seriously. How many of you are using PowerShell in production? Clap, I can't see you. There you go. All right. If this is going to be a critical part of your infrastructure, if it's going to make stuff work, you gotta treat it seriously. And that means a couple of things. Kind of the two main pillars of this talk are maintainability and reliability. Making sure that your scripts work, that you can get to a working version, and that someone else can read the damn thing. Because in 6 months, you're someone else. And you're going to be looking at a script you wrote going, what the? Well, there are ways to make that easier. And if this is going to be something that saves you time, you don't want the thing that saves you time to be taking more time in and of itself. So that's what a lot of these practices are around. So let's just leap right in and start with the one key practice that we all need to know about. How many of you believe that documentation is important in a script? Yes. So let me get over here. I also like the idea of documentation in a script. Push the right button. There we go. I like the idea of documentation in a script. PowerShell has something called comment-based help, where you can take the comments that you would normally put into a script, and you can make them useful to someone reading the script and someone running the script or the command. This is a big deal. The first thing I think anybody should do when you start typing a function or a script is immediately put in a comment block and start filling it in. Now, this is all documented. About comment-based help in the shell shows you all these different keywords like synopsis, description, parameters, examples. A lot of you should start thinking, if you haven't, about having corporate standards, organizational standards. What is our minimally accepted script? Before something can be used in production, it needs to meet some standards. I think what you're looking at here is the minimum. A synopsis, one or two sentence description of what it does, a description, and for heaven's sake, be detailed. You know, if this is one of those things where this script creates new users, okay, do I need to be a domain admin for that, or is it magical? Is there any other information I need to know about? Is it possibly dangerous? List all that here, because the future will appreciate it. Provide a description for every single parameter, and provide a couple of examples so I don't have to search the internal SharePoint thing for a discussion on how to use this. Just show me how to use the stupid thing, okay? The comment-based help is the starting point. I do like to see inline comments. I'm opening a session. You'll notice that I tend to get in the practice of putting a comment on all my closing brackets that tells me what it closed. Because you know what, at the bottom of the script, when you've got 17 of them lined up in a row, it's a little hard to remember what they're for. And this is just a nice little visual reminder. Don't do this. I know that's what write debug does. That's why it says write debug. PowerShell's language is a little self-documenting, right? Use full command names. Don't use aliases in your scripts. Use full parameter names for every parameter, and the comments aren't as necessary on a single line-by-line basis. I have some aesthetic preferences, and in the PowerShell book, we actually lay aside some separate things that are aesthetics, because not everybody agrees on aesthetics. I think that's a lovely shirt, for example. Not a fan of that one. So I don't personally like to see this kind of thing. If I wanted page breaks, I'd use Word. Some folks like that. But try within your team to come to some agreement about what things will look like. Because there's a thing that happens in your visual cortex when you look at something like this, and you have to adapt before you can start reading. And if you can all do the same thing, you'll spend less time adapting and more time actually taking the meaning, the semantics of the script into your mind. I like comments like this one. What is this logical construct doing? Well, it's testing to see if I used this $usedecom, and if I did this, then I'm going to use decom, otherwise I'll use sim. Okay, that's useful. That's helping me understand the logic. It's useful. This, I'm not sure. This will query three things. Well, that's shocking, because there's three queries there. I would have expected different. So, you know, you don't necessarily close this giant line. Close the session, giant line, remove session. If your comments are substantially increasing the amount of data I have to suck in through my eyeballs, you're not helping. So comment intelligently. All right, that's probably enough about comments, but they're important. And usage examples are one of the most important things that you can do with your comments. Let's talk about performance. This, weirdly, is the single most thing people got agitated about in the scripting games. And I think I figured out why. How many of you have written in a language like C# or VB or something that gets compiled? Yeah? Okay. A lot of the times in those languages, you can take different stylistic approaches, like you can format your code slightly differently, and it won't matter because at the end of the day, the compiler is going to chew it all up and spit out the same thing. So you can do things that look attractive in source code, and the performance is not affected in the end. PowerShell's not quite like that. The way PowerShell works, and it's important to understand how it works, there are times when you have to make a trade-off between attractive looking and something that you might feel aesthetically is less attractive, but it performs better. And so a lot of people got into a back and forth. Well, you shouldn't do it that way. I downgraded you because the way I like to do it is faster. Yet, dude, I'm processing two things. How much faster? Like did a fruit fly die while we were running this? Because that's pretty fast. So the practice we came up with to accommodate sort of all those differing opinions was, if performance matters, test it. That seems straightforward, doesn't it? But if you're coding something and you think performance is going to be a concern because I have to process 80,000 files, well, start testing it and measuring it. Here's a couple of very general guidelines, not even rules. If you are piping something, it can be a little slower to run sometimes than a structured approach, and I'll show you exactly what I mean, because that's not a rule, it's a general guide. But piping often uses less memory. Structured approaches often use a little bit more memory, but can sometimes run more quickly. And it depends a ton on exactly what you're doing. I'm going to show you a couple of somewhat limited examples that I think really highlight this. There's three different approaches that do exactly the same thing. In the first approach, I'm running a command that's going to retrieve, I don't know, round number 100 objects, let's say. I'm sticking them in a variable. I have to keep all that stuff in memory now. It's in a variable. It's living in memory. It's taking up space. I'm then using a for each block to go through those, and I'm outputting the name and the total amount of VM plus PM. Okay? The next one's doing the exact same thing. But here I'm piping them to for each object, which is running substantially the same write output command. So I'm piping them. That means I'm flowing those through from one command to the next, and I don't have to store them all up in memory at any given point. So that second approach, I'm guessing, is going to use less memory. The last one, I'm not even doing this business of enumerating objects in my script. I've gone with a command that will do this for me. Yeah, I swear to you, did anyone participate in the scripting games last year? You remember the awful and the pain and the kvetching and the complaining and the angst and the soap operas? We were going to film a soap opera about it. People would put these examples up and go, this one's faster. I'm like, you can't possibly say that. I don't know what I'm processing. If it's important, measure it. Use measure command. All I've done here is wrapped my three different approaches in a measure command, and I'm going to run them. So before I do that, real quick, in your head, there's three things with performance. CPU, right? Memory, yes. Disk. Network isn't going to come into play here. That's the fourth big one. Thinking just of time, how quickly is this going to occur? Right in your head, right now, pick one, two, or three. You decide, and we'll see who's right. The first approach took 64.4 milliseconds, the second one 41.9, and the last one 40.6. This one was slower. This was next, and this was next. So see, a lot of times the predictions you might have in your head based on the, well, I know what PowerShell is doing under the hood, and so I'm pretty sure this one's going to be faster, might not be true. It depends a lot on exactly what you're working with and what you're doing. And the only way to know is to try it. I do classes all the time. And I've been doing PowerShell for close to 8 years now in classes. And you know, after a while, you just don't care what people think of you. And I'll have students, and God bless them, they're just getting started, and I shouldn't be this mean. But just don't care. They'll sit there and we'll be like on Wednesday and they're like, what would happen if I ran this? I don't know. Try it. Try it and see what happens. We'll reset the virtual machine. It's fine. Sometimes you just got to get in there and try these things. So if performance matters, the only way to know is to measure it. How many of you are developers? Okay, do this. Just for like 30 seconds. You know how developers will sit in the lunchroom and they'll argue about the best way to structure a certain piece of code? But they won't just go try it. Well, no, it'd be much faster if we just did this and this and this. Go try it. I don't care what you think is faster. This isn't a theoretical exercise. We don't live in college, except those of you who do. Just try it. So if performance is a thing, you've got to measure it. And that's the only way to be sure. Oh, you know what? Actually, let me flip back over, because I've got one more good example on that over here. everything. So the thing was, the comment was, write output has a different performance characteristic based on what it's doing. And I was using it slightly differently both ways. Everything has different performance characteristics depending on what you're making them do. Let me see. Oh, you know what? We'll come to that one later. That one's got a nice little ugly thing on it. Some basic aesthetics. Something else that I do to my classes that's a little bit mean. I will not help students if they have not formatted their code nicely. There's two reasons for this. Yeah. The reason you're clapping for is only the first reason. Badly formatted code sucks. It makes everyone's life harder. It makes your life harder. It's harder to debug. And the minute you say that, some students are still not doing it. I'm like, you can't possibly think you're not going to ever have bugs. Just start formatting your code nicely at the outset. Assume you will have bugs, you arrogant little. And those are the 10-year-olds. So the other reason is I'm over 40 and I refuse to wear my glasses and I just can't see all that well. So I need to bump the font size up a little bit. And if I told you the number of times I've walked over to a student and they spend the time formatting their code nicely and I finally look down and I drag the ISE slider over to 300% or whatever my eyes need, and I'm like, yeah, that parentheses isn't a curly bracket. It's supposed to be a curly bracket, not a roundy bracket. And if you didn't have the font size set to 6-point, you'd know that. So readability is important. Now this last one, this other one, testify on the indenting code. I know most people are there. Just take your time and do that right. But this other one, I think this other point is a wee bit less obvious, which is to avoid the back ticks. Now look, these three commands all do exactly the same thing. The first one stretches everything out on one line. That's fine. You know what? Honestly, my own personal tolerance is if it fits on my 11-inch laptop and doesn't stretch off with a horizontal scroll bar, that's good. The minute I get near the end of the line, did anyone take typing class? Is anyone like my age? And you know the little ding? Thanks. You know the little ding when you got in the danger zone? It was like finish the word and hit enter. I have a little mental ding. And when I get to about the last inch of screen, it goes off in my head. And I immediately think, this is too long. I can't do this. Folks will go for the second approach. I hate this. I hate this for some specific reasons that I will share with you. One, when you print that in a book with the back ticks, it looks like stray toner and people forget to type it. They do. Second, when your font size is like that, you can't see the dang things. Third, the back tick, contrary to what many people think, is not a line continuation character. There's actually a help file in PowerShell that says the back tick is a line continuation character. And I like to jump up and down and scream about it because it's no such thing. It's an escape character. It escapes whatever's right after it. If whatever's right after it is a carriage return, then it has the effect of being a line continuation. But what if there's a random piece of white space afterwards? I just broke the universe. And there's no way to see it. So avoid the back ticks. Try to. Instead, here's an approach you can use. I have built a hash table. That's what the at sign and the curly brackets are for. Each key in the hash table is a parameter name, and then it's followed by its values. And Jeffrey Snover will be angry if I don't show you that he likes to do it this way. He likes to have them all lined up. I think that's just a little OCD, but yeah. Suck up to the engineer. I get it. Notice what I'm doing when I run the command. I'm using that variable name. Variable names don't include dollar signs. It's just the variable name. Instead of preceding it with a dollar sign, what did I use? An at sign. This is called splatting. Now you can go home and tell everybody, heck, get on Twitter, sat in a room with Don Jones and splatted. It's taking those keys and values and feeding them to the command. So you can have a nice line-by-line breakdown of your parameters, which I think looks good. I think it's very readable. I think it's very easy to go and edit that. It's much easier to stick in variables and expressions and things like that. And then the command itself immediately follows the hash table. What I don't like to do, and you might like this, and that's fine. You can be as wrong as you want to. What I don't like to do is line up a whole mess of hash tables and then nail all the commands in. I want parameters, command, parameters, command, parameters, because if this goes with this, that's where I want it, right there. Visually close, because I got to read this thing. I don't want to have to go see get sim instance at params. Oh, crap, where's that? Scroll. I don't like to scroll. It makes it harder for me to understand, so I don't like that. So splatting. There's also rules in PowerShell about when you can legally line break without having to do a carriage return. For example, get sim instance, class name, whatever. Pipe. The pipe is allowed to be the end of the line. You can have white space after it. It's fine. Notice the squiggly? Can you all see the squiggly? That's the squiggly. PowerShell knows I'm not done. It's waiting for more. Export CSV details.csv. That's legit. You can legitimately hit it after a semicolon or a comma because it knows those things indicate delimited lists, and so it goes and it looks for more. So there's places where you can legally make your code look more attractive without backticks. So try and focus on those. There's times when I've had to use the backtick. It's just I nearly always have to put a comment right above it. Those are backticks, not stray toner. Make sure you type them, and there's like a lot of caveats that go with it. So just for easier legibility, try and avoid those if you can. Output. Y'all know how I feel about Right Host, right? Yeah. Word got out, dead puppies, the whole deal. Right Host draws pixels directly to the console screen. When you use Right Host for any purpose at all, whether it's just to display that line by line, I'm now connecting to this computer, I'm now doing this, that what I call the warm and fuzzy output, whether you're using it for that or to display error message or anything else, as soon as you use that, you are hard coding yourself to a visual, human, interactive metaphor. That is the only way the script will work. You cannot capture Right Host, you cannot redirect Right Host. It's not output, it's just pixels on the screen. The problem is your scripts aren't always going to run on the screen. They're going to run under task scheduler, they're going to run under SCOM, or they're going to run in SMA or something else, and there's no screen there. And so Right Host becomes a difficult way of doing anything. Instead, use one of the commands that we were given. For that warm and fuzzy output, that's Right Verbose, because I can turn that on or off. If I don't want to see all of your warm and fuzzy output, I don't have to look at it. Right Warning, Right Debug, Right Error, Right Output. Those are all the intended ways of doing output. And you can see in that first example, because I wrote this function with commandlet binding, this is an advanced function or a script commandlet. I automatically get a whole bunch of like 6, 8, or 10, I forget, a whole bunch of parameters and a whole bunch of functionality free of charge, built right in. I don't have to do anything for it. I don't have to work for it at all. I can just use Right Debug and Right Verbose. And if someone runs this with minus verbose, they'll see my verbose messages. If they don't, they won't. If they run this with minus debug, they'll see my debug output, and it'll stop. It'll pause at the right debug and ask me if I want to continue or suspend or just give up and go home. So you get that functionality for free. Other hosting applications can capture verbose and debug and warning and error. They can capture those discrete streams. For example, I have a customer who wrote a custom host that they use when they run things scheduled. Anything written to the error stream gets logged to a text file. Anything in the verbose stream gets logged to an event log someplace. And they can turn those things on and off at will. So different hosts can implement warning, verbose, debug, error, and output in a way that makes sense for that context. So when you use those, you are fitting into the broader world of PowerShell. When you use Right Host, you're drawing stuff on the screen. Now, that's not to say that there is no circumstance where you would use Right Host. If you are writing a script or a function whose verb is show, That verb tells me this is going to put something on the screen. For example, show IT support menu. Okay, that makes me feel like this is intended for human interaction and I would have no reason to run it as a scheduled task. For example, now you can tell everyone that you saw Don Jones use Right Host. This is a perfectly legitimate approach, right? You've put together a bunch of tools. You want to share them with your help desk. You don't want to crank out a graphical user interface or anything like that. This is what I call a controller script. You'll notice that it isn't doing anything. It's presenting a list of options, and then based on those options, it is running one or more tools that actually do things. So I've separated the functionality from the presentation. Get OS info might also be run in several other contexts. It might be part of a larger controller script that does an inventory. It might be part of something that runs as a scheduled task. I don't know. Crazy stuff. But the point is, by separating these things, I've created a context where it's acceptable to use Right Host because the point of this script is human interaction. Now, what I don't like is to see this, and in here, instead of simply running a tool, you got a bunch of code that does stuff. Because now you've locked that code into this one context, and if you want to use it somewhere else, you're going to have to copy and paste it, and what's that mean? Now you've got two things to fix when you find a bug. So I do like to say, and we'll talk more about that separation in a little bit, because that was another practice that we kind of identified. Oh, apparently we'll talk about it now. Tools versus controllers. This is my first job out of high school. I was an aircraft mechanic apprentice, a civilian for the Navy. And I got to rotate through a lot of different shops, worked on F-14s and A-6s, and one of the shops we worked in was the machine shop. Because it turns out you can't just pick up F-14 parts at Walmart. Go fig. So we had to make a lot ourselves. And the machine shop was really divided into two worlds. And I think there's a lot of applicability to our world. One world was the machinists. And they had these big milling machines, and they would put tools into those milling machines, giant glorified drill bits, basically. And they would sit there and stare and watch while particles of metal flew off of the giant piece of metal stock. And it was hot, and it was dirty, and there's oil being sprayed everywhere to keep all the parts cool, and it was disgusting, and I hated it. I was there for a week, wanted to kill myself. It was awful. They were tool users. Once they got good enough at being a tool user, they could go for a promotion into a small air-conditioned CAD CAM room where the tool makers, the tool and die makers, made the specialized drill bits, where they designed them. So they would design a drill bit, and then the 10 tool makers would all go off and go, go. It's hot. Which job would you rather have? I decided I wanted to be a tool maker, and this goes the same in IT. You got tool users, you know what I'm talking about. You got the folks who run the scripts, but then you got the folks who make the scripts. Who's easier to fire? Yeah, not the guy who knows where all the code is. So start getting into a pattern of building tools. And here's some kind of guidelines for this. Where are we, number 5? This isn't a fancy script, but I put it in a script so it'd be easy for you to download. A tool does one of three things. It provides input for other tools. And these tools should start with names like get, or import, or convert from. They're doing something, getting file off disk maybe, getting information out of a database, but the purpose of this is to go somewhere else. Maybe they're getting computer names out of the configuration management database. Or a tool processes something and produces output. Tools with names like get and set and new and remove. The doers, the makers, the shakers, the things that make things happen. And then there are tools that simply take output and make it attractive. Export, convert to, format, maybe out. They're not inventing new data. They're not creating anything. They're simply taking something else that someone else did and dressing it up. Think of them as the desktop publishing people of the PowerShell world. Here's a great example. Now, this is a command you've probably not seen before. And I know everyone sees this all the time, but this is a very, very important concept here. When you look at the default output of this, this is not the actual output of the command. PowerShell's formatting system has already kicked in and made this pretty. So two things happened when I ran this. The tool produced its output and PowerShell made it pretty. We can look at the raw output. I'm just going to grab one of the processes so it doesn't scroll off the screen. That's the raw output. And I want you to notice something different. These memory values, kilobytes, megabytes, the CPU is in seconds, that's not what we get here. A tool that is doing something produces the rawest form of output possible because you don't know how that's going to be consumed down the line. Don't fight to make your tools produce pretty output. If you need pretty, tell PowerShell's formatting system to make it pretty for you. That's step two. Keep your tool output raw. Also, don't make assumptions about where your tool will be run. You don't know, which is why tools accept input via parameters only. No read host. God, I feel the same way about read host as write host. Must be the host word. Don't lock yourself into a paradigm. Make tools that can run anywhere. Right, you know, I've got this thing over here that we've been looking at, get OS info. I need to prompt for a computer name to make sure I have one. That's all I have to do. Hey, PowerShell, this is mandatory. If the idiot didn't provide a computer name, bug him. I didn't have to code that. I get that free. And that's the right way to do it, not chucking in a read host. Because if this runs in some other host, it can decide how to deal with that input. Right, it might decide, I can't provide you that input. I'm running unattended. I'm just going to crash and log a bug. So you play along with the way the PowerShell wants to be used. At the end of the day, I am writing output to the pipeline. That means when I run this, I don't need to know where it's going to be used. Maybe today I want it in a CSV file. Maybe tomorrow, convert to HTML. Maybe later, I need to pump it to a SQL database using another command I've written. But the point is, if you play along and you write tools that are constrained and that only do one thing, you don't have to decide now. You get all that free. So it's a really important design principle. A controller, on the other hand, a controller is tied to a specific process and a specific context. It automates a business process. They're usually single purpose. You usually can't use a controller for five different things. It's tied to its one thing in the world. It encapsulates your input, your processing, and your output. It combines things together to form Voltron, a business process. It might not have a commandlet style name. And that's okay, because it's not running like a PowerShell command. It's not following those patterns and practices. It might display information directly to the screen. It might not. This is what creates your provisioning process. This is what displays a menu. This is what displays a GUI. This is what creates a report that involves several different pieces. So tools are reusable units of automation. Controllers take those tools and put them to a specific purpose. A tool is a hammer. What can you do with a hammer? Well, it depends on the controller. If the controller is a general contractor, you can build a house. If the controller is a serial killer, you can bash in someone's head. It's a multi-purpose tool. The tool doesn't know how it's going to be used. It's just hard and swingable. Controllers, you're going to write both. You're going to write controllers. You're going to write tools. Make sure in your head you know where the difference is. Okay. Don't waste effort. Who likes to waste effort? Let's get some pictures of these people. They probably work for the DMV, which is who gave us ITIL. It's snarky, but if you think about it, it's true. So the first thing here is don't reinvent the wheel. And I have a great example of that, but we're going to talk about the second point first. Report bugs in the product. Make suggestions in the product. Who does not know where, and this is a serious question, you can raise your hand, I'll shade my eyes. Who does not know where you go to tell the PowerShell team you found a bug, either in a command or documentation? Who does not know? Okay, all I needed was one hand. Connect.microsoft.com. You log in with your Microsoft Hotmail Passport Live ID, and you can do suggestions, you can do bugs, and you can search for other people's to see if there are workarounds and to vote. And let me tell you something. I don't work for Microsoft, but I know how they work. They're a large, publicly traded company. If you put a bug in, they're not going to call you on the phone the next day and say, hey, thanks for that, we're going to get right on that. They can't. They got to be careful what they commit to because you're going to hold them to it, and they've got priorities. But I can tell you at the last MVP summit, they set a bunch of people down and made them go through the freaking bug database and make sure everything was reproducible and help prioritize it so the team could go fix them. There are human beings with names and families who read all of that input. When PowerShell 3 came out, there was a README doc early on in its preview cycle that showed the names of the people, the bug number, and what they had done about it. It works. There were 60-some features in PowerShell 3 that came right out of the community. Take the time. Don't just whine about it. Whine in the place that will get it fixed. Understand you're not going to get a phone call back from them right away, but it's being read anyway. It does work, trust me. So for the previous bit, not reinventing the wheel, I see this a lot. I have defined a parameter, a switch parameter called verbose, and I've defined one called help. And look at the first block starting in line 10. If someone runs this with help, I'm displaying help by using write host. When you see this, I want you to cry. I want you to go, I give up. I'm just going to go paint. Because we already have a way of displaying help, and it's comment-based help, and it will look exactly, I've seen people do this and take the time to format out their help screen so that it looks just like a standardized help screen, and I swear I fall to my knees, and I give up all hope on humanity. That's why I'm here today, to save you all. So you don't need, that's not the right way to do help, and that's not the right way to do verbose either. Notice down around line 21, if he said verbose, then set the verbose preference, you don't have to do that. All you had to do was put in commandlet binding and you would have got the verbose parameter for free, and it would have turned write verbose on and off for you. Don't work harder than you have to. There's enough work out there. There's plenty of work. You don't need to make more for yourself. So there's a lot of reinventing the wheel there. This sort of thing. Oh, you didn't provide a computer name, so I'm going to prompt you for it. All you had to do was mark the parameter as mandatory. PowerShell would have taken care of that for you. Because now you've got to put in a... What if you run this? What if this is the code you run, and someone just hits enter? Well, now you got to check it again and put it into a loop. And if it's in a loop, you got to have a way to get out of it. So now there has to be an exit option. You just made work for yourself. PowerShell would have done it for you. Look into those things, right? That's one of the reasons I wrote a book called Toolmaking, is to help people understand that PowerShell will do most of this for you. And when it does, you get the benefit of having your code look, feel, smell, and taste just like a real PowerShell command, and all the benefits that accrue thereon. So, you know, try to not make extra work for yourself. Source control. How many of you have scripts that are not in some kind of source control? Yeah. And the person sitting next to you is lying. I know. Look, I coded. I was a VB script guy. I had all my stuff on a file share, if I was lucky. Most of it was on my laptop because I had to take it home with me at night so I could play with it. But source control. If you got TFS, put your PowerShell scripts in there. If you got CVS or Subversion, use that. If you've got a Git repo, use it. Sapient Technologies has a product called Version Recall. that just every day goes and makes a little backup of all your files in your scripts folder. If nothing else, right? Because you want to be able to screw up, because you're gonna, and go get the last known good version, right? When you push a script, how many of you have coworkers? Yeah, they suck. Because as soon as you get something working right, what are they gonna do? Break it. Oh, you didn't define a verbose switch, so I had to go in there and do that. Now the entire thing exploded into a million pieces and the world is no longer rotating and we're all gonna fall off. Well, you need to be able to go get that last known good version. You need an authoritative place where things can live, where people can find them, so that when you get hit by a bus, the rest of the world can carry on. That's your legacy. I have to tell myself that, because otherwise I can't even get out of bed. That's your legacy. Source control. Use source control. You know, it doesn't have to be difficult. There are commands to check things in and out of a GitHub repo. People have written commands to interact with Subversion and CVS, so you can make it relatively simple on yourself. There's a lot of different source control solutions out there. I'm sure most of you have probably got Git, Subversion, or TFS already on your network somewhere. Well, you might as well use it. Take it seriously. I do a lot of consulting, business-level consulting, which means I'm talking to directors and executives. That's what my company does. We help them try and understand what their technology challenges are. They tell us what's painful, and we say, well, here's your problem. And we try and help them identify areas of solution. We don't sell software. We don't sell hardware. We don't tell them what to buy. We just say, these are the capabilities you need to add to your environment. And we talk to a lot of them. And PowerShell almost always comes up in the conversation these days. You know, it seems like we're managing more and more servers. It seems like things are getting harder and harder. I'm like, well, in the Microsoft side of the estate, at least, why aren't you using PowerShell? And you know what? 99% of the time, if they're not already using PowerShell, you want to know why? They don't trust you. They're scared to death that their admins don't have training as professional developers, whatever that means, because I've seen computer science classes and that ain't it. They're scared that their admins don't have training as professional developers and that they're going to write crappy code, and they're a lot more worried about, I don't want my guys and gals writing scripts because then I won't know what happens if they quit. How many of you have heard that? Yeah. That's a real concern to a business. So if you can demonstrate that you're taking this seriously, treating it like code, you get taken more seriously. And I'll give you another bit of advice in that direction too in just a second, but think about how developers in large enterprises treat code. It gets checked in, test people check it out, get the latest version, they test it, they send back a bug, the bug reports get logged, log the dang bug reports. That's part of the neat thing about TFS is it's got all the buggy stuff built in, Git does too. Right, so you can go and you can go back and forth, and when it works, it gets released, and that version gets marked as the release version, so you can go back to it. Does that slow things down? Yeah. Are you in a hurry? No. Get it working. Check it in. Release it. Comment it. Treat it like a real thing. How many of you have some problems getting your bosses to invest in your time to do PowerShell? All right. Little free tip off the slide, because this is my own personal campaign these days. Again, I worked for the civil service, and we referred to ourselves as old missiles because we did not work and we could not be fired. You're welcome. And if anybody buys a used F-14 on eBay, but it was difficult to get promoted. And the way you got promoted was when a job posting went up, they had to, by law, detail every skill, knowledge, and ability. Knowledge, skill, and ability, KSAs. We had an acronym for it, KSAs. Every KSA that job needed. And there's a form that you fill out indicating that you have all those. And so they told me when I started my apprenticeship, they said, you are going to learn something new almost every single day. I said, yes, sir. He said, write it down. Gave me one of the marbled cover, you know, composition notebooks. They write down everything you do, so that when you have to fill that form out, you've got it all there. Well, the lesson stuck with me my whole life. I haven't had a real job in 10 years, but I have a resume, and it's always updated. And here's what you need to do. As you automate things, first find out how long it takes to do that task manually. Somebody comes to you, hey, we need a script to do such and such. No problem. How long does that take you to do manually? About 5 hours. How often do you do it? 2 or 3 times a month. Okay. So that's 10 hours a month, roughly? 10, 12 hours a month? Write that down. Measure how long it takes you to write the script. You know why? That's called ROI, boys and girls. It took me 10 hours to automate something that takes 10 hours per month. Next month, we recoup that investment. After that, we have return. And then the next time you need to fill out your resume, you know what I want the number one bullet point to be? And I'll give you a hint, it's not got a four-letter acronym. I saved my employer 30,000 hours of manual effort by using Windows PowerShell to automate previously manual tasks. The rest of your resume needs to have your phone number and a smiley face. That's it. Because I don't care what company you apply to, that is getting you an interview. And if the CIO doesn't interview you, talk to the CFO. He knows what the numbers mean. So this is, again, about taking what you do and treating it as a professional career. Document your successes. No one else is going to pat you on the back. But that promotion or that next job will certainly be a nice reward, and that's how you get it. And source control and treating your scripts like code is professional. You guys have heard DevOps. You know what that means at the end of the day? Be a programmer. That's all it is. Be a developer who uses domain-specific tools like PowerShell that are uniquely suited to what we admins have to do to solve business problems and treat it professionally. I promise you, you will thank yourself, and you can buy a round when you get the new job. I like bourbon. Good bourbon. All right. This was a huge, huge, huge argument point when we did the games, and we actually called this debate point the PowerShell purity laws. And you know, at first, I kind of had this pragmatic attitude about it. Here's where it started. I think we did something where we wanted someone to map a drive. Part of the script assignment, the puzzle, was mapping a drive. You guys know how to map a drive? Via the command line? Yeah? Net use. So I see the script and I'm like, eh, okay. Net use, that works. I'm fine with that. Somebody else instantiated a file system object, a COM object. That made me kind of tense up a little bit. Somebody else just said new PS drive, dash persistent. I'm like, yeah, you know, I always forget that's in there now. That's good. Well, then the entries got out to the community and the public started commenting. And oh, my Lord, it was the Salem witch trials. You would have thought they had made racial slurs on some of these things. Some people did make racial slurs in their comments, I swear. So here's kind of where we got to, and I'll show you an example. Whenever you can, accomplish things by using pure PowerShell commands. PowerShell commands. There's actually a good reason for this. It's not just an abstract purity thing. It's because PowerShell commands tend to be documented. The command names tend to be clear. They tend to have a help file. And little trick, the word commandlet didn't mean anything before PowerShell came along, so add that to your search engine. So when you're looking up a command, new dash whatever commandlet, you're probably only going to get back PowerShell-related results. So there's a good reason to use commandlets and commands whenever you can. Devolve to the .NET framework or to COM or to a command line utility when PowerShell doesn't give you what you need and this other way does. Freak and spend 5 minutes making sure PowerShell doesn't actually do it. And here's the difficulty. Every new product version that comes out, PowerShell does more. So you're going to have to re-educate yourself every so often on what PowerShell can do, but devolve when you need to. However, don't overthink this, right? Think about why we want to use pure PowerShell. Maintainability, readability. It's easier to read the command. I can look up the command. I can look up the parameters. Don't go to such great lengths that you are destroying the whole point of using the command in the first place. I apologize if this example looks familiar to anyone in the room, but this is something we saw. So the first block, net use. Unless you're using PowerShell version 2 or prior, you don't need to do that. PowerShell 3 lets you do a persistent. Now, what was a little better here is we mapped a network drive, but we provided a comment. I'm mapping a network drive. This script is going to need to run on PowerShell v2 and later, so I cannot just use new PS drive. Yeah, okay. This is like that comment that says, the following code is involved with Y2K. Do not touch. At least you're explaining that there's a reason. So some other schmuck doesn't come in here and think they're all intelligent, rip that out, replace it with something that won't work where it needs to run. You've done something a little hacky, but you've copped to it, and it's okay. Now, the other bit about this is you'd better be right. Right? Because if you put, this needs to run on PowerShell 3 or later, so we can't use new PS drive, you're dumb. So make sure you're right. What would be better, if you can, is to use native PowerShell, and that's what the last approach does. New PS drive, PS provider file system, name, here's the root. I didn't use minus persistent. I didn't indicate that I needed to in any of the others, but I could have. Don't do the last bit. Look at what this is doing. I've gone and created a whole new function called new network drive. I'm not even sure that's the right verb for this, honestly. I'm passing in a path as a parameter, and then I'm looking at the $ PS version table to see if the PowerShell major version is less than 3. And, you know, the presumption here, and I didn't add this to the example, the presumption is that this would be persist, which was only in version 3 and later. This is not helping anyone with readability. Because when I actually use your script and I see new network drive, now I'm going to have to go look at what that does. So now you've made me context switch over to here to look at your little brilliant piece of code, and I'm going, really? You know, if the goal here was just to be backward compatible, let's just use netuse and call it a day. Let's just be done. Don't overthink this. The point of pure PowerShell, the community consensus, was readability. Not necessarily it makes you a better person. Nothing's going to help with that. Well, bourbon. So don't overthink this purity thing too much. Don't go to great lengths to make it pure. It's a readability thing. Don't break readability getting there. Does that make sense? Yeah, jiggle your heads. I can see that. Great. You do have to periodically go revisit things, you know, as your environment moves along. And you're in an old script, you're like, geez, we wrote this back in 19-dickety-7, and now we don't have to do these 10 lines of code. There's one command that does it now. That's not a bad time to update, maybe. I've talked with a few folks here, and you guys have been really gracious with your time and speaking with a lot of us to help us understand what your problems are. Not issues, those are for magazines. We have problems. And I think a couple of conversations I had were to the effect of, you know, there's just so much of this new stuff in PowerShell every single day, I'm having trouble keeping up. Yep. That's going to be the difference between folks with jobs and folks without jobs. The ones with jobs will be able to keep up. And you're right, it got harder. Sorry. But it did. And it's even challenging for me to keep up. But you do need to periodically go revisit what you've done and make sure that's still a good way to do it. Who's ever gone and refactored a script? Good. Good. Who's never gone back and revisited a script now that you're embarrassed to? Well, you need to. It's a good thing to go back. Because when you wrote your first PowerShell script, were you as experienced as you are now? Well, it's a good exercise. How many of you struggle to find things? You know what? I think I could do more with PowerShell if I just had a reason to get into it, something to work on. Yeah? That happens all the time. Make your old scripts that reason. Force yourself to dive back in and reinvestigate and make sure that you're doing things the right way. It'll help tremendously. Trust me. So we do have some time, and I've got a couple more examples I want to dig into. But I want to make sure that before I do that, you've got a chance to ask questions and offer commentary. So if you do, this is a good time to start filtering toward the floor mics. so that we can do that. I'm going to keep going because I do have a couple other things to cover. And the next one is right here. Take a look at this. This is another example of performance. Line one is not the example. Line one is just creating 1,000 items. 1,000, right? Yep. I've got two approaches to this. Both of them are using a construct, right? So they're both using for each. This is fun to kind of think about what PowerShell does. The first approach is creating a new object, piping it to add member 3 times. So I'm running add member 3 times. Each time, add member is piping it on to the next one until it gets to the end. And this is just adding 3 arbitrary properties. The second approach is creating a hash table with the 3 arbitrary properties and then creating an object that has those. These are doing the exact same thing in terms of result. Raise your hand if you think the first one will run faster. How about the second one? I kind of hope this is a trick question now. All right, I'm going to clear the screen and run it again. Did you get it all? Which one do you think was faster? Yeah. Well, obviously, if performance is important, measure it. So I've wrapped those in measure command. The first one took 810 milliseconds. The second one took 239. That's a difference. And that's only 1,000 objects. Who has more than 1,000 Active Directory users? Yeah. So you start processing things in bulk, and those small differences add up. So it's another example of, and one of the reasons I brought this up is, you know, a lot of folks look at this and they're like, well, it's just piping everything right through. And so, you know, there's not a lot of memory being used and things are just going to flow through and all these commands kind of run quasi-simultaneously. So that first one's going to be a lot quicker. Turns out not. Never guess. Because you don't know. It's also important, and I don't think a lot of people realize this, it's important to test on the versions of PowerShell where your script will run. Because there's this team at Microsoft that codes the product, and they're still doing it. And they find out about performance problems through connect.microsoft.com, and they work on them. Do you know what one of the big differences was between PowerShell version 2 and PowerShell version 3? It was refactored. PowerShell was refactored to, instead of running in the .NET framework common language runtime, the CLR, it runs in the dynamic language runtime, the DLR, which was a huge, free, massive performance boost for all of us. But different operations get boosted differently. So it was important for people to go back and retest their performance assumptions because the product had changed substantially. So it's always something to keep in mind. If you have something that's going to be deployed across multiple versions, test it. Document your conclusions in your script. Put a little code block. Using this approach, because when I tested it on PowerShell version 2 and 3, this ran much faster than the alternative. See end of script for alternative. And at the end of the script, comment block, this is the alternative I was talking about, hunk of code as a comment. It's not going to kill anyone. It's not in line, so it didn't force me to read your mind. It's at the end, it's a reference. Because you know what? After you get promoted to CIO, and I have to come in and maintain that script, and we're on PowerShell 12, and I go and look at that, I'm going to go, we're testing this again, just to revalidate. So document those things. That's massively important. Good? Okay. All right. I think I'm probably going to wrap us there. The slide deck and the recording have got that URL where you can get all of the code. And I'm going to blast right through to the important one because a few folks asked about this, and I want to make sure everyone's aware how to do it. You can scan the QR code. You're going to complete your evals. There's no paper evals. You're going to do your session evals in your TechEd login, your attendee login. The QR codes get you there quickly. It's hugely important for all your sessions that you do evals, not just because you can win an Xbox, but because it provides Microsoft with a lot of feedback on what sessions to feature in the future. So look, nobody's asked questions, and that's cool, because I just make fun of you anyway. But if you want that to happen one-on-one, I'm going to go right down to the scripting guy's booth, which is in aisle 1400, and I'm going to hang out there for about half hour, 45 minutes, answer questions. I'm probably not going to be at the show much tomorrow, if at all. So last chance, if you need a book signed, please come by. If you want to say hi, please do that. If you have a question, please do that at least. And if not, PowerShell.org, friendliest PowerShell Q&A forums on the internet. Guys, enjoy the rest of your show, and thanks for coming here. I hope this helps. Thank you.